And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. We've all heard this story before. A child finds a parent's gun somewhere in the house. The child thinks it's a toy. Accidentally, the gun goes off, and the child dies. But is this type of accidental death entirely preventable? It certainly is foreseeable. If it's foreseeable, is it therefore preventable? Personalized guns, sometimes called smart guns or childproof guns, are firearms designed to operate only for their authorized users. The technology for these types of weapons has been around for decades and continues to advance. Leading public health experts believe that these guns have the potential to prevent thousands of deaths a year. That includes deaths from accidental shootings, like the one I just described, youth suicides, and homicides. One study using data from Maryland and Wisconsin found that personalized guns could have prevented 37% of unintentional gun deaths. But at the moment, no such firearm is available for purchase in the American marketplace. Gun rights groups, including the National Rifle Association, have pushed back against legislative attempts to mandate these types of weapons federally. And locally, gun dealers have been wary about selling them. In fact, in Rockville, Maryland, when a gun shop owner agreed to retail a smart gun at his store, he received so much criticism, including death threats, from gun owners and Second Amendment proponents that he quickly changed his mind and decided not to sell them. So why are smart guns so controversial? And what are the arguments for and against mandating their sale? And what are they all about? How do they work? We're going to dig into this subject in this hour of the show because of a report that's out from the ABEL Foundation, one of the co-authors of the latest ABEL report, Personalized Guns Using Technology to Address Gun Violence, is joining us in the studio. That is Stephen Terrett, professor of health and public policy at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he directs the Center for Law and the Public's Health. And he's a founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. Stephen Terrett is a co-author of this new ABEL Foundation report that I just mentioned, and we welcome you to the show today. Nice to have you on the show, Steve Terrett.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Smart guns, the idea of a smart gun, a gun that's has safety attached to it in some way, so that only the owner can use it. This goes back actually quite a ways, doesn't it?
Well, the idea has been around a long time. Actually, there was a precursor to smart guns, which was a childproof gun that could work for most anyone other than young children. And that was developed by Smith & Wesson back in the 1880s. The story for that, and the story appears in a book that's the authorized corporate biography of Smith & Wesson, is that one of the partners, the founding partners, D.B. Wesson, heard of a young child using a Smith & Wesson gun and injuring someone. So he instructed his son, Joe Wesson, a gun designer, to come up with a gun that a child would be unable to use. Joe did that by putting a metal lever in the back of the gun, and the idea was that a child's hand was both too small and not strong enough to push down that metal lever at the same time he was pulling the trigger, so the gun wouldn't fire. So that's well over 100 years ago. If we fast-forwarded it in time, there are more recent attempts to make guns personalized, not just childproof, but personalized or smart guns. Some of those used mechanical devices, and just now we're getting to see some attempts with electronics.
Microchips, for instance, and fingerprint technology.
Exactly.
You use the term personalized guns, and I use the term smart guns. We can use those interchangeably during this hour of the show.
I use those interchangeably, okay. Yes. Some people also use owner-authorized guns, and sometimes people use childproof guns.
And Steve Terrett, your co-author on this report for the ABEL Foundation, the ABEL Report, is Natalie Drayson. Who is Natalie?
Natalie Drayson is an extraordinarily talented student that I have the pleasure of teaching. She's a Master of Public Health student in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. And at the same time, she's getting her Master's in Business Administration at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School.
At Johns Hopkins at the Center for Gun Policy and Research, your colleague Daniel Webster has been on our show before to talk about gun safety. You actually research how guns are used in America, how they're used in homicides, how they're used in deaths, and ways to prevent some of these deaths.
Yes. Daniel is the current director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Safety. As you mentioned, I had the privilege of being the founding director. Daniel is one of the nation's leading experts in understanding how guns are used.
Well, some of the numbers that jump off the page at me in the context of this idea of using smart guns to prevent unauthorized users from using them, whether it's a three-year-old child or someone who steals a gun from a house. Let me just throw this number out because it jumped off the page to me. 500,000 guns are stolen each year in the United States.
Yeah, these are guns that are stolen from homes during home burglaries. And those data were compiled by two researchers who at the time were at Duke University, Dr. Philip Cook and Dr. Jens Ludwig. It is an amazing number that 500,000 guns would be stolen from homes during burglaries each year. What's even worse than that, though, is that those guns tend to enter the illicit market, so they're sold to people who want to use guns frequently in a criminal fashion.
Okay, let's apply the idea of a smart gun technology to this particular problem of stolen guns going into the illicit market. In theory, conceptually, it sounds like a great way to deter people from reusing guns, reselling them, or even breaking into homes to begin with.
Sure, if the gun is stolen and the gun technologically is a smart gun, which by definition means that it can only be used by the authorized user, the owner, then it's going to be worthless on the illicit market and it's not going to be used in mayhem like standardized guns are now used. So in that case, we would likely see a reduction in gun assaults and gun homicides if all guns were smart guns.
Going back to the history for a moment again, Smith & Wesson, whatever became of their ideas, their concepts for a safety gun on guns?
Well, they made that gun, and they started to sell it in the late 1880s and sold it until 1940. They sold 500,000 of those guns, 500,000 of those guns. They stopped selling that gun because around 1940, they got a contract from England to make handguns for the war effort. So they made a different kind of gun. After the war was over, though, they returned to making guns for domestic use, and they didn't reemploy that technology. If you want to know why didn't they do that, then you'd really have to ask Smith & Wesson. But what's important to me, one of the things that's important to me, is they didn't have to do it because we as a country in the United States don't regulate the safety of guns as a consumer product. The Consumer Product Safety Commission is expressly prohibited from doing so by Congress.
Ah, another fact that jumped off the page to me. The Consumer Product Safety Commission was blocked by Congress in 1976 at the bidding of the National Rifle Association?
Yes, that's right.
So that the CPSC does not review assess firearms?
They're not permitted to exercise any jurisdiction over guns or ammunition.
One might suppose that at the federal level, a regulatory approach to mandating the design of safer guns could be accomplished through that agency, but they're blocked from doing it.
One would hope that the agency would be allowed to do that, but that would be a false hope. They're not allowed to do that.
Bring this completely into the 21st century for us, then, would you, Steve Terrett? Companies are producing smart guns, is that correct? They exist?
There are a limited number of companies that are producing smart guns. I would say that the one who's in the forefront with regard to production is a company that's based in Germany. It's called Armatix, A-R-M-A-T-I-X. And there is a U.S. subsidiary, Armatix USA. They have a gun that currently they make only in 22 caliber, but they're about to start making that same gun in 9mm caliber. And that gun uses different technologies to make it fit the definition of a smart gun or a personalized gun. Yes.
How is the gun personalized?
Well, Armatix uses both radio frequency identification, which is often called RFID, which means that you have to have on or about you essentially a transmitter. And inside the gun is built a responder to the signal. And if that gun is in the proximity, really close to the transmitter, which in the Armatex gun, the transmitter is in a wristwatch, then something electronically moves so that it's no longer blocking the firing mechanism within that gun. So that's principally how the Armatex gun works, although they're also experimenting with fingerprint reading technology.
You make reference in the report to, I don't know if it's Armatex, whether it's Armatex or another company that has the RFID in a ring. So you put a ring on a finger and that connects to the gun.
Yes, people have done that. There's another company that's leading the effort here. It's called TriggerSmart. It's a company that's based in Ireland, and they use RFID technology also in a ring. It could be on anything. It could be on a pin that someone wears, a wristwatch, a bracelet, a ring. It just has to be close enough to the gun so the gun knows I'm in the hands of the authorized user. If you took that gun away from the person, from the owner who has that wristwatch or bracelet, then the gun would automatically lock. So, for instance, if you had this kind of gun, you were wearing the wristwatch or the bracelet or the ring, if I were an assailant, took that gun away from you and tried to turn that gun on you, the gun wouldn't work for me. It would only work for you.
Armatex, the German company that you're talking about, made arrangements to sell the gun in Maryland and California.
Yes, that's right.
What happened? Because you can't buy this gun in Maryland currently, right?
You can't buy it currently, but the president of Armatex USA has recently told me that she expects that the gun will be available nationally very, very soon.
Huh.
But currently, you can't buy it. What happened, and there were similar stories in both the Los Angeles area and Montgomery County in Maryland, is that a gun retailer decided that this is a gun that maybe would help some people, maybe some people who previously didn't want to buy a gun because, let's say, they have children in the house, maybe they would want to buy this gun. So they made it known that they would soon start to sell the gun. With regard to the Maryland dealer, that was made known through a story in the Washington Post by a reporter, Michael Rosenwald. As soon as it was known, then let's focus on the dealer in Maryland, that dealer started to receive threats, death threats, not only death threats against him, but death threats against his dog.
Against his dog.
His dog, who works at the store also.
I think you're referencing Andy Raymond.
Andy Raymond,
right.
Yes,
this is a story.
Right.
Now, this is a follow-up story to the Washington Post piece by Reuters in May of this year. Said Andy Raymond, co-owner of Engage Armament in Rockville, dropped his plans to be the first in the U.S. to sell this so-called smart gun made by this German company after a backlash that included death threats. He says to Reuters, "I can't have my shop burned down. I have people to look out for." He said on his Facebook page that he would back off the planned sales. What explains this reaction? We're going to get into that a little bit in this hour because you're doing your report as well.
Yes.
Trying to understand what the objection is to the sale of smart guns.
It's a complicated answer, unfortunately. But some people are worried about the first sale of a smart gun in the United States because of a law that was passed in New Jersey about 12 years ago. And that law said that as soon as a personalized gun is available for retail purchase in the United States, and that gun is authorized by the New Jersey Attorney General as meeting the statutory definition in New Jersey of a personalized or childproof gun, then a clock starts to tick in New Jersey. And at the expiration of 3 years under the provision of this law that was passed in New Jersey, then the only gun, handgun, I should say, that could legally be sold in New Jersey would have to be a personalized gun. That law, while it made a great deal of sense when it was passed, and we could talk about that if you'd like, has become a bone in the throat of the National Rifle Association, an organization called the National Shooting Sports Foundation, or NSSF, which is the trade association of the United States gun manufacturers, and some other pro-gun organizations and individuals. So they were fearful that if the first Armatex gun is sold, whether it's in California or in Maryland, that that would set that clock ticking in New Jersey. Now, the reason that they're fearful goes a little bit beyond that, which is, and this is discussed in part in the Abel report, is that the United States gun manufacturers over the years have actually been doing quite well financially with the sale of guns, and the guns that they sell are guns that were designed essentially 100 years ago. They haven't had to retool their factories. They haven't had to invest in research and development. If a personalized gun starts to be sold in the United States, whether there's a mandate like the New Jersey law or whether it's by sheer market forces that people are interested in this new kind of gun, that's going to put the U.S. manufacturers in a financial quandary. And it's my guess that that's why the NSSF, again, the Trade Association for the Domestic Gun Manufacturers, has been so deeply in opposition to the sale of a personalized gun. The manufacturers in the United States would have to either license the technology from foreign companies like Armatex and TriggerSmart, and they would also have to retool their machinery so that they could start manufacturing those guns.
We have to take our first break here on Midday. We'll come back and talk some more with Stephen Terrett, founding director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and director now of the Hopkins Center for Law and the Public's Health. Excuse me. We're talking about his report delivered for the Abel Foundation, Personalized Guns Using Technology to Address Gun Violence. Lots of interesting information here about smart gun technology and the resistance to it, the opposition to it. We welcome your questions. 410-662-8780 is the phone number for Midday. I have some emails to read already. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. In a few minutes, we'll post the a PDF of the Abel report on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page so you can read it yourself. Well, here's an interesting reaction to our discussion about personalized guns with Stephen Terrett from Johns Hopkins. This is David writing in to say the smart gun is an idea developed, marketed, and discussed solely by gun prohibitionists. It is not seriously considered inside the gun culture, nor will it ever be. We believe a gun must go bang every time. It is the single most important attribute of a defensive firearm. Johns Hopkins think tanks notwithstanding, the people who carry guns into harm's way are never going to embrace this technology. Many modern pistols do not even incorporate thumb safeties or grip safeties any longer. There is no mechanical safety that can safeguard against negligence. Guns are an awesome responsibility, must always be treated with respect for their inherent danger. Well, I agree with that last part. That's certainly true. But in practice, what do we see in the United States in terms of the tolls that guns take in accidental shootings? In the previous hour, I mentioned suicides. I don't think I was far off with my recollection of the impact of guns in suicides.
I agree with the end of that statement that guns need to be treated with respect, but I also agree with what your point is, Dan, that in the United States, in the latest year for which the federal government has released data, which is 2011, there were 32,351 gun deaths. Now, just to put that in a slight perspective, there are about 35,000 motor vehicle-related deaths. So those deaths have been coming down while gun deaths are going up. So we'll probably see more gun deaths than car-related deaths soon in the United States. Of those deaths, 61% are from suicide and 35% are from homicide. The unintended or unintentional deaths represent a small slice of that mortality pie, but we still see close to 600 gun deaths in the United States that are accidental or unintended, and many of those could be eliminated if we make guns a safer consumer product.
What did I say? If something is foreseeable, it should be preventable. It seems like simple logic, doesn't it?
Yes, I think that that's exactly correct, and these gun deaths are foreseeable. You know, in the world of public health, which is the world that I live in now, we don't use the word foreseeability. That's more a word that lawyers use.
And radio hosts
yeah. use, but there's what we call an epidemiology to these deaths. It's not a mystery as to who's dying, under what circumstances they're dying, when they're dying, with what kinds of guns are they dying. And with regard to the deaths that are the accidental deaths, many of those are to children, and they're based on scenarios like the one that you used in introducing the show, where a child picks up a gun in the home that is perhaps kept loaded because the person wants the gun to be accessible. Maybe the child, if he or she is young enough, can't distinguish between a real gun and a toy gun. The trigger is pulled and someone very sadly dies. It's those deaths that can be pretty much eliminated if we had personalized guns. And with regard to David's comment about prohibitionists, he says that this is an idea that comes from prohibitionists. Actually, this is an idea that initially came from me, and I don't consider myself a prohibitionist. I think that there are some guns that some people should be allowed to have. And we know now that the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution is interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court as agreeing that there are some guns that some people have a constitutional right to have. But in spite of the fact that I and many of my colleagues are not prohibitionists, that doesn't mean that we should give up an opportunity to save some lives. We should make guns safer the same way we make cars safer, the same way we make aspirin bottles safer or toys safer.
Everyone's always questioning motives, where you come from. At the Bloomberg School of Public Health, you look at trends in our society. There's a bunch of epidemiologists over there who look at different conditions in our society to try to improve public health, in this case, public safety.
Yes. You know, we have a lot of people at the School of Public Health who work, for instance, on malaria, a horrible problem that kills so many people worldwide. It's interesting that one of the things that a lot of our scientists are doing now is trying to figure out, is there a way to redesign the gut of the mosquito so that the mosquito is not carrying the germ, in essence, that will give you malaria? That's what we do in public health. We don't just look at people's behavior. We don't say to people, can't you be more careful and stay away from mosquitoes? Instead, we redesign the mosquito, just like we redesign the car. This is what we're talking about with regard to personalized guns, not taking someone's gun away from him, but redesigning the gun so we'll save some of the unnecessary deaths.
Let me ask you about something else David said. We believe a gun must go bang every time. If you own a gun and the gun recognizes you, a smart gun, will it not go bang?
David's gun will go bang when he's holding the gun. If it's a smart gun, he doesn't have to worry about that.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here if you'd like to join our conversation. If you have any questions about this, I'm learning more about smart guns here as we go along. And from Stephen Terrett's report that he filed for the Able Foundation, published as an Able report for August. Stephen Terrett is a professor of health and public policy at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he directs the Center for Law and Public Health. You can now find a copy of the PDF of the Personalized Guns Report by Stephen Terrett and Natalie Drayson on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Another comment here by email. Let me see what we have in this one. This is from Murray, writing to us from Clearville, Pennsylvania. He says, I own guns, and as such, I am a target for the NRA's mailings. I find their pathological hatred of any type of control to be very disturbing. In their magazine, the NRA has a page of stories where having a gun saved people's lives or prevented a rape. It is likely that these stories are true or true enough. However, I feel that for every story of a save, there should be 14 of a family member dying by accident or suicide. I have rifles but no handguns because my wife thinks it wouldn't be safe for her should she ever get very depressed. Not a chance I'm willing to take. Let me ask you about suicide. The use of guns in suicides in the United States, do we have any information about who owns the guns that are used in suicides? Do we have any information about that?
Well, oftentimes the person who commits suicide with a gun will be the gun owner. And oftentimes in some research that's been done by a colleague of ours, Dr. Garen Wintemute in California, that gun had been recently purchased, leading one to suspect that maybe it was purchased for the purpose of suicide. But gun-related suicides are not restricted to those who own the gun. Teenage suicide by guns is a very difficult problem in the United States. For that most recent year for which we have data that I mentioned, 2011, people between the ages of 10 and 19 committed suicide with a gun 849 times that year. If that person, the teenager who might have been just momentarily depressed, was not the authorized user of the gun, and if the gun were a smart gun or a personalized gun, then that teenager's life would likely be saved. Now, someone might say, well, they could just commit suicide in another fashion. There's actually been a lot of good research done to see if people substitute another method for suicide. And while I'm no psychologist or psychiatrist, the findings show that people tend not to substitute something else, that it's cause-specific, that if they want to commit suicide with a gun, that doesn't mean they're going to do something else. The second point about that is, again, going back to how public health people like to talk, there's a high case fatality rate if you want to commit suicide with a gun. And what that means is if a person holds a gun to his or her head and pulls the trigger, there's a very high likelihood that that person is going to die. There's not a whole lot that can be done for that person when that person's taken to an emergency department. Whereas if the gun were a personalized gun that wouldn't work for that teenager, let's say, and the teenager took, let's say, pills, there's an antidote for opioid overdoses that could be administered that could save the life, but there's no antidote for the gunshot wound to the head.
Let me throw this out to our listeners. I'm curious what you're thinking about this. If you own a gun presently for defensive purposes, you keep it in the house, what do you think about having a smart gun instead, which would make you the only person who could use the gun, using this technology that's, I guess, apparently it sounds like it's going to be going up for sale. There'll be another attempt to sell it in the United States by the German company you mentioned, Steve Terrett. I just wonder, people who presently own guns, would they switch to a gun like this? Or if you were thinking about buying a handgun for your home, would you consider smart gun technology? And for those of you, maybe like our earlier writer in here, David, who just feels like you can't just grab it and use it, is there a delay of some kind? I assume the smart gun has to obviously recognize the rightful owner before it can be activated, right?
In the technologies about which we've been speaking, the fingerprint reading technology and also the RFID radio frequency identification, the delay is measured in hundredths of a second. So it's not as though you have to turn something on, it warms up, and then maybe 10 seconds later you hope that it's going to work for you. That's not the case. You know, we live in a world now that's full of personalized devices. I have a car. I suppose I shouldn't say the make of my car, but I have a car now where I never take the key out of my pocket. I walk up to the door that's locked, and I can open the door.
My brother has one of those. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Whereas someone who doesn't have the key in his pocket can open the door. When I drive home, if I want to open up my garage door remotely, I push a button. My door goes up, but my neighbor's door doesn't go up. And if my neighbor pushes a button, my door doesn't go up. So we have devices like the new iPhone now, which recognizes a fingerprint so that only the authorized user can use the iPhone with the fingerprint recognition. My generation probably doesn't fully embrace the idea. I don't know what generation David is of, and probably doesn't matter. But my generation may not fully embrace the idea of this kind of newfangled technology. But I think that the newer generations do it, and that's why I and others think that there's going to be a market demand for this safer kind of
you do.
Gun.
Yes, you do. Either new users or people who presently have guns who just want more safety associated with the gun?
Yes. There was even the most recent James Bond film, the name of which I don't remember.
Skyfall. Was it Skyfall? Where he used there's a smart gun that's...
Yeah, so someone takes a gun away from James Bond and wants to use the gun against James Bond, but he can't because the gun works only for James Bond. It's a personalized gun. So this is becoming built into the culture, present-day culture, that we should expect a gun to do this. Guns are the only product that I can think of that really haven't had electronics built into them. And it's an oddity. I said before that the guns that are designed today are the guns that were designed the same way 100 years ago. We need to change the design of guns so that they're still going to work for the people who lawfully can buy them, but they're not going to work when the three-year-old picks up the gun and points it at a playmate.
Or when someone breaks into your house and gets your gun. And I just want to go back to that number one more time, because just for emphasis, it's an impressive number to me. 500,000 guns stolen annually in the United States in home break-ins. This is Midday. Dan Rodericks here speaking with Stephen Terrett, professor of health and public policy at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, talking about a report that he co-authored for the ABLE Foundation, the ABLE Report for August, Personalized Guns, Using Technology to Address Gun Violence. Our subject is smart guns, gun technology. 410-662-8780. I'd like to hear from you. What do you think about this? To me, it seems pretty logical. I just wonder what the opposition is. Steve has tried to explain that. We'll get into that a little bit more after this break. 410-662-8780. Thank you. Okay. What about biometric sensors? Is that a palm print or fingerprints on guns?
Those are the main biometric sensors that are being considered for guns now. As I say, there are companies that are actively working on fingerprint reading technology. Fingerprint reading technology has existed for decades. It used to be, though, that the question that was raised was, will the computer chip that recognizes a fingerprint be able to withstand the repeated trauma of a gun being shot? Hmm. Will the computer chip be durable enough? That was a concern before. It's essentially no longer a concern. There's another biometric detection device that looks essentially at pressure points in one's palm, and that's being worked on and has been worked on for quite some time now by the New Jersey Institute of Technology. So there are a few different ways that one can use biometrics in making guns personalized.
Stephen Terrett from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health joining us in this hour to talk about his report for the ABLE Foundation, the ABLE Report for August, Personalized Guns, Using Technology to Address Gun Violence. You, in addition to mentioning Armatix, the German company, your report mentions iGun Technology back in 2002, a subsidiary of Mossberg.
Yes.
A technology group developed a personalized carbine or long gun. That was the one I think used a ring, maybe, for identifying the owner through radio frequency identification.
Yes.
You mentioned, of course, Smith & Wesson. Then Kodiak Industries is another one. That they have technology to read fingerprints.
Yes. In January of 2013, about a month after the shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, President Obama issued, I think it was 23 executive orders with regard to guns. One of those executive orders was directly related to gun technology and personalized guns. And in that executive order, he asked the Attorney General Holder, to convene a study through the National Institute of Justice to see where technology stands now. And the National Institute of Justice came out with a report about a half a year later, in the middle of 2013, that said that there were a number of companies around the world, some of them here in the United States, some elsewhere, and it categorized them as to the level of development of the technology at which those companies were. Some, like Armatex and TriggerSmart, were at the highest level of development, meant that essentially they were ready to roll. They could bring out a gun. Others were in a more earlier developmental phase, I should say. But there are a number of companies that are interested in this now.
No, they must be interested because there's a market. They must believe that there's a market for them.
Yes, they do believe there's a market.
Let's go to the phone lines and take some questions for Stephen Terrett while he's with us here. Frank in Ellicott City, welcome to Midday. Go right ahead with your question, Frank.
Yes, I was wondering if these methodologies and technologies could be adapted for more than one user on the same gun. For example, someone who wants to buy a handgun for self-defense for both he and his spouse, but would rather not have two guns in the house.
Thanks for the question, Frank, and the answer is absolutely yes. So depending on which technology we're talking about, if it's fingerprint reading technology, you could program as many fingerprints you want. My wife recently got one of those new iPhones that allows her to put in her fingerprint, and I insisted that I wanted to be able to play with the toy as well. So we put in my fingerprint. With the RFID, you could put an entire police department's fingerprints, each officer in the police department, so that policemen can trade off guns, or if one policeman went down, the other policeman could grab that person's gun. So, yes, absolutely, there can be multiple users who are authorized.
John in Frederick, we'll go to you next with your question or comment. Welcome to the show.
Hello. The thing I find curious about this gun or these specific guns and the legislation that is sort of becoming popular around the country, like we have it here in Maryland where there's a licensing procedure for handguns, it doesn't seem like we're really trying to get guns out of people's hands. It seems like we're trying to get guns out of people's hands that are lower on the economic rungs.
Is that a concern of yours with smart guns? Because you hear smart guns and you think more expensive.
Well, I would imagine that they would be more expensive as the technology creeps into guns, that the prices would go up. And in Maryland, as an example, to get to own a firearm in Maryland, if you're buying a handgun, there's a licensing process that you have to go through, and it's pretty expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that it's more aimed at a certain economic group than at the population at large.
Guns are pretty expensive, aren't they, John?
Not necessarily.
No? I mean, I've been with people spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on guns, more than $1,000 on guns. So I'm not that familiar with the market, but I've noticed that guns have gotten pretty expensive. What's the cheapest gun you can buy in Maryland?
An unscientific answer would be around $125.
Mm-hmm. That's
legal purchase. To get a brand new single shot something would be, in the low $100 range. Inexpensive handguns certainly can be had for around $200. I can't imagine these guns that we'd be talking about would be anywhere near that price. And the cost to get the permit to hold the gun would cost certainly more than the guns, even ones that you could buy now, inexpensive ones.
What do you think of before Steve responds to this, I just want to ask you, John, I'm sorry. What do you think of the NRA's opposition to smart guns?
Well, I'm an NRA member, and I do find that they tend to just kind of be against anything that could restrict guns in any way, and I don't necessarily agree with that. However, we do have a lot of legislation made by people who really don't know anything about guns at all. And so the legislation ends up really not making much sense either. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of nonsense, unfortunately, on both sides.
Well, you know, what impresses me about this is we're not talking about legislation necessarily. We're just talking about the product, the technology in the product. What would be your opposition to having such a product sold if it's going to make guns safer? It's going to make society somewhat safer, not a complete guarantee, obviously, but it would, you know, save some lives, probably. The logic seems to say that.
I'm just making the comment that these laws generally seem to be aimed at an economic group rather than making guns safer.
Okay.
For example, the licensing issue here in Maryland, again, I mean, it is cost prohibitive.
All right, let's go to the cost question about accessibility to guns for people of multiple social economic classes. Does smart gun technology put guns out of reach for people of you know, lower income people?
Well, John, I generally think of myself as a skeptical person, but I think you far surpassed me here. I guess one can say that, yes, if you increase the price of any product, then it's going to become more difficult for people of lower economic status to purchase the product. And you could also say that if you increase the safety of a product, it's likely that that's going to increase the cost of the product. But let's talk about other products. So, you know, for blenders that people would use in the kitchen, there are some safety devices that keep us from getting our fingers cut off. I don't think that there's ever been I've never heard anyone suggested that there was a plot to keep blenders out of the hands of poor people or better braking system in cars or airbags or even seatbelts in cars. All of that drives the price up.
I would say only add that when you have new technology that's being developed and isn't in wide use yet, the initial stages of that sale of those sales in the marketplace usually are higher. So
yes, and right. Then economies of scale bring the cost down. When I first bought my first calculator decades ago, I can't even remember
Texas
what I
Instruments.
Paid for it.
Right, right.
And people give them away now.
See, do you get my point, though? John brings up legislation, and he wants to talk about the expense of getting a license in Maryland. That's a different issue, a different day. Here we are talking about technology and a product. Does it require any special legislation for us to have these for sale? It doesn't seem like it does.
No, and that's one of the big debates going on now with regard to personalized guns or smart guns, about whether there should be a legislative mandate, and if so, what should that mandate be, or whether we should just let the market forces do their trick and see if you put that kind of gun, new kind of gun, safer kind of gun out there, whether people will buy it. So if you don't have a legislative mandate, and by that I mean if you're not saying, like New Jersey did 12 years ago, at some point in time all new handguns have to be personalized guns, then you're still going to have the old-fashioned type of guns that would be available for people if they don't want to spend the extra money.
Then you get the slippery slope. That's the complaint, the slippery slope. If you mandate such a thing, then the prohibitionists will be taking all our guns away from us, the old guns away from us. So by not mandating it, just letting the market forces leave the market forces at work, maybe that's a better way to go with this politically.
Yes, and then there's an in-between type of policy which would be a legislative mandate, but one that doesn't prohibit old types of guns from being sold, but one that says to a gun manufacturer, whether it's Smith & Wesson, Colts, Beretta, Ruger, that you should offer at least one model within your array of guns that you make and sell. That's a safer gun. That's going to be a personalized gun. And then, again, the people have the choice. Let them vote with their feet as to whether they want to go for the smart gun, which will cost a little bit more, but probably not a lot more, or whether to go for the old, less smart gun.
Just a note to our listeners, we at Midday did reach out to the National Rifle Association for comment on this topic of smart guns, but at this time we have not heard back from them. There was one other number in your report that I wanted to just talk about here for a minute. We only got a couple minutes left, Stephen Terrett. $100 billion, the estimated cost of gun violence in the world, in the United States?
In the United States per year.
Per year. And just quickly unpack that for me. This goes back to the year 2000. Some researchers named Cook and Ludwig.
Yes, these same researchers that I mentioned earlier. It's important to note that that figure, which is an astoundingly high figure, is both direct and indirect costs. So it's not only what it costs when someone's taken to the hospital and the doctor costs and lost wages, but all of the societal costs that are built around gun violence. That would include courtroom costs, the judicial system, the police enforcement costs. But however you cut it, it's a gigantic chunk of change, and we're living in a world now here in the United States where we're doing everything we can to get medical costs under control, and we actually could reduce the national costs of medical care if we reduced the gunshot wounds in the United States.
Stephen Terrett, a professor from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, visiting us today, director of the Hopkins Center for Law and the Public's Health, is co-author with Natalie Drayson of the ABLE Report for August, Personalized Guns, Using Technology to Address Gun Violence. Recommended reading here, really interesting stuff. And thank you very much for coming in to elaborate on some of these points. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you and to your listeners, too.
Steve Terrett. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into our Midday today. I want to say thanks to the Bagby Pizza Company for providing lunch for our guests today. Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building in Harbor East, offering brick oven, thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches, pasta, salads, and more. Open daily 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with delivery available nightly from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great afternoon. See you soon.
Midday Senior Producer is Nikki Gamer. The Associate Producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Our interns are Connor Graham and Marjorie Goodman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WIPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR, your NPR news station.